Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone. In now, your host, Paul Mercurio.
Hey, everybody. This is Paul Mercurio, and welcome to this week's podcast. Very excited and honored to have as my guest Mr. Jeff Fager, executive producer of 60 Minutes. He's been in that position since 2004 after taking over for the famed Don Hewitt. And he was also chairman of CBS News from 2011 to 2015. And he is the man behind the show that you have admired for all these years. And it is an honor and really great to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Paul.
So I think we should talk about how we first met. I work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and I was doing warm-up and getting the audience going, and I see this somewhat dignified gentleman sitting down front, and I'm like, oh, okay, let me bring this guy on stage and chat with him for a minute. And as he's walking across the stage, I say to the audience, look at this rich son of a bitch.
I thought, oh boy, you're in deep trouble now.
And so I say, boy, look at this guy. He looks rich. I go, do you run a hedge fund? And he says, no, I work in this business. And I go, oh. I say, oh, what would that be? And you say?
CBS.
And I turn to the audience and I say, this is my last day working for CBS and The Late Show. And I say, where at CBS? And you say,
60 Minutes.
And the crowd goes crazy.
Yeah, they did. It was really exciting. It was amazing. It actually made me feel good about the whole experience because, you know, we don't have, you know, we broadcast, it goes over the air. We get letters. I've got a whole stack of them here. I love to hear the audience response, but then to see them spontaneously cheer like that was exciting.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, this is obviously an institution. I'm sitting here in your office and, to my right, it's like 17, 18 Emmys. I mean, they're not yours. None of them have your name on it. But and then to my left is all these Peabody Awards. And I thought you were so cool, you know, to be so open to let like an idiot like me, you know, play with you and everything like that.
No, it was fun. You know, I'll tell you something. In the tradition of Don Hewitt, our creator, who was an amazing character, his picture's up there. He was the most fun guy you would ever meet. So full of life and spirit. This was never a corporate place. It's a newsroom.
Right.
And we all come from the news business. And so it's, the doors are all open. There's a lot of shouting.
Yeah.
We care about it. The place is, you know, and there's a lot of fighting over,
right,
you know, single lines and words and phrases and getting our, you know, our process, getting to the final story is, it's not, there's nothing formal about it.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of people that are pretty down to earth, and there are a lot of really crazy people.
Well,
here,
you know, like working on The Daily Show and the other shows, The Late Show with Colbert, is if people get very passionate in what the point of view is and what they're trying to just say, even though it's jokes, and there's a lot of yelling and fighting and the times, but the informality surprises people.
Yeah, it's informal. I think people are also surprised how young it is up here. A lot of young people. You know, it's funny with the creative process. I think that is what the natural outcome is, that it gets kind of feisty and that it can be fun at the same time.
But I think you need it because it creates a more relaxed atmosphere.
But also that somehow, and I think you would probably say this about The Daily Show too, at the end of the day, all these different people, and there are about 75 reporters up here, you know, six or seven of them happen to be on the air. When the story ends up on the program Sunday night, it looks like it belongs, you know, and that's how we collaborate to make it feel like it belongs, to make it the substance of it belongs on 60
what
Minutes.
Is it about a 60 minute story that makes it look like it belongs?
Yeah, there's no one way to define it.
Yeah,
it is the culture that brings that out. But when you watch it as a viewer, you're not surprised.
Right.
You may be surprised by the content, and we like to be as unpredictable as possible. That's a huge part of what we do.
Yeah.
We don't ever want to come across as predictable, or it should always be original. You know, I say it all the time, original reporting is what we value the most, which is became our CBS News slogan.
Right.
I said it so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe in it. And I think the viewer sees that. They watch 60 Minutes and they know they can expect something that's interesting that they might not ordinarily have thought they'd be interested in.
Yeah, literally hundreds of millions of viewers over the 30-some-odd years.
50. We're going to our 50th.
This is
our,
you know, you're involved.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So I've been here since... off and on, back and forth, 1989 was my first year.
You were in San Francisco working there. I know that was one of your early jobs.
Yeah, my first job was in Boston at what is now the CBS affiliate, WBZ.
Right.
I came here from San Francisco in 82, so I've been 35 years at CBS.
Yeah, News. And you grew up in Wellesley. One of my best friends lives in Wellesley. I spent a lot of time up there. And
fantastic.
WBZ, where you worked. I know I watched a lot.
Yeah, so BZ, that was actually my first job out of college.
And you went to Colgate and graduated Colgate.
Yeah, but it didn't. I got a schlep job. I mean, I got a job sweeping the floors and delivering lineups. I was the lowest form of life in that television station.
But you probably needed to see all of that, right?
Well, no, I didn't. I mean, I wanted to be in the news business, I thought, and I could write from my college experience where I learned to write. But I needed a job to pay the rent, and it was ground level. Why not? What was great about WBZ is that there's a radio station there, too. The Spirit of New England, I grew up with it.
Yeah.
So I was fascinated by it.
Absolutely.
And I went in there and just said, can I write the news for free?
Bob Lobel was a sportscaster.
Lobel. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm a huge Boston sports fan, and we used to watch him all the time.
That's funny. And I loved it there, but they let me write copy for free. And I parlayed that into my first job, editorial job, writing news copy for WEEI, which was a CBS-owned radio station,
mm-hmm.
all news.
Right.
And
it's all sports now. I have it on my phone.
It was all sports, right. Yeah, but I got fired from that job because it was incredibly intense and great experience. You had 2 hours to write an hour. That's how limited the staff was.
So explain that. It's all news and
it's all news. Mm-hmm. It's going for an hour and you basically as a writer had to
How does that happen? I mean, you're coming out of Colgate, great school, but we all know school is not real life. I mean, who's teaching you?
You know, in the news business, you just have to try. And for me it was just speed of typing. And in 2 weeks I got really fast.
Electric typewriter?
No. I think there might have been some electric, but most of them were manual.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how goddamn old I am. what happened with that job, I learned so much and I got really good at it. And they fired me because I wouldn't pay my union dues. Because the union initiation in the Writers Guild was $500. That was like, at the time, this is talking about 1978.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, my apartment was like 3 months rent on Beacon Street.
Right.
How the hell am I going to pay $500? And they finally said, out, you got to go. The union saying we can't keep you. A week later, all of the writers walked out because we were making less than minimum wage.
Really?
And they said to all the writers.
But aren't you union rep?
Yeah, that's what I mean. And I'm paying union dues and $500.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. And so they told all the writers, just stay out. And they brought Emerson College kids in. None of those people went back.
And you didn't go back?
Oh, no. I got fired. They said, you get out of here. Coincidentally, everybody walked out in protest about a week later.
Yeah, and in reading about you, there's a word that jumps out. And by the way, in a minute, I want to talk to you about fishing.
Yeah.
I know you striped bass fish, and so do I. We go up to Mystic, Stonington.
Fantastic. Here it is.
There you go. Yep. Yep.
That's Chappaquiddick.
You went to Chappaquiddick on your honeymoon and you...
Yeah.
Yep. And there's my boy.
Fantastic. Beautiful.
Long Island Sound. That's, you know, like one of the first ones we got. We're showing pictures of fish right now, everybody.
I can tell you how big those fish are, too.
Exactly. Exactly. Fillet them.
Yeah, those are great. Those are the best eating because those are around 30 inches.
You use eels? What do you use? Swimmers?
No, I use all lures.
Mm-hmm.
I love to fish for the bass at night.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my favorite time. I'll show you this summer's picture. I fish at night on the beach. The surf casting is at night. We have a boat. I go out, but I love to fish on the beach.
Yeah, we have a whaler that we go out on. It's great.
There's something really nice about being on the beach, you know?
Now, aren't they, they're usually hiding in the rocks, aren't they?
No, we don't have rocks.
But they're out there.
They're on the beach. They're the current where we are. It's right on the corner of Martha's Vineyard, Chappaquiddick. See that southeast corner called Waisque Point? The tides come together and there's a rip there. So there's a lot of...
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What was weird about this is they close the beach to trucks. We drive on the beach. They close it in June for the nesting birds.
Mm-hmm.
So I take a skiff over, and my skiff got beached, so I had to swim the fish home.
Wow. Are we talking 40? What are we?
Yeah, That's about 44-inch fish.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a hell of a fish.
Get some nice meat off of that.
They're not as tasty when they get that big. My wife wrote a book, Living Off the Sea.
Yeah, from all of the cooking you do.
We do so much cooking because we really do live off the sea. We don't buy our dinners. You know, we get vegetables at the market, but, you know, it's all we catch every day. And it's gotten so elaborate that, you know, she'll send me out for sushi, which is our favorite sushi is the black sea bass,
mm-hmm.
which I can get. I call it going to the market. You know, if I get in the boat, I go to get the black sea bass, I can be back in no time at all. It's a lot faster than going to the actual market.
Yeah, we have a bluefish tournament that we do.
We do too.
You know, Lord's Point, and it's really awesome. You know, you go out.
Yeah.
There's rules. You have to leave 5 to 7 at night. Leave at 5.
Cool.
Be back at the dock by 7, and there's a weigh-in, and there's a juniors division.
Cool.
And you sign up, and there's one guy, he's got the board, he's been doing it for 50 years. And,
yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Our derby lasts a month.
Oh, wow.
It's a month, and everybody shuts down. It's like, as my wife wrote in her book, for the entire month, the sign Gone Fishing is out on everybody's. It's a fishing culture, and the whole place stops.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's tough where I am up in Stonington on the Sound. It's like you got to kind of be out in the ocean, you know, on a boat. It's tough to get it off the shore.
See, this island's out in the open ocean, and they come and they find this place where there's a lot of bait fish.
Right.
So they're a little bit more aggressive here. And we'll catch them in the rip with the boat just a quarter of a mile offshore with the little ballistic missile that is the orange popper, looks like a squid.
Right.
And you see on some casts 10, 15 bass aggressively coming out of the water to get it.
Because up there, they're sitting in the rocks and they're kind of waiting for the bait fish, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure our boat fishing is very similar.
Yeah, we use poppers and swimmers, you know, just below the water. I got a couple of lucky ones, you know?
There you go, yeah.
Yeah, you know, we go out and, you know, you're doing off the rocks and stuff like that. And we get this place to race and, you know, there's these currents. And so the bait fish are flying through and they're just, the bass are just waiting to jump on them. And then, you know, and we got two buddies of mine. We all live in the same community. And one of them, he's got this outcropping of rocks, like literally 50 yards from his back deck. He's right on the water. And one night he just wasn't getting anything. So he goes, let me go try these rocks.
Wow.
And he gets a 53-pounder.
This is fantastic.
Sitting there right in the rocks, stones over his house. Yeah, yeah. It's like you know, and it's just crazy, you know.
Close to a record, too, I'm sure.
And he's going everywhere, like Watch Hill.
Yeah, and there he is right there.
You know,
sure,
right in front of him. Yeah. And now it's something my son and I have been doing for years.
And so have my sons and my daughter.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah,
it's
fantastic. My sons are now 33 and 30. And as little guys, that's their first memory is fishing with their dad and my buddies.
Yeah, the first time we got it, you know, we caught it. We got the fillet and the meat. And he was so excited to, you know, like we like to cook. He was so excited to cook it. And
my kids prefer bluefish, by the way, because we always have bluefish. And I got to get you my wife's book because the recipe for bluefish is so important.
Well, my wife was reading about it and we start talking about it.
Yeah.
And she goes, oh, this book's great.
Well, part of you want it because part of it is the preparation of the bluefish because I bleed the bluefish.
Yeah, you got it.
And you know that already.
Right.
That changes everything about the bluefish. Kind of a white fish when you cook it.
And we have a friend that has a great recipe for smoking it.
So do we.
You know, with some like cream cheese and chives. It's. But I'd love to get the book, absolutely. So in reading about you, the word that comes to mind and pops out for me is instinct. Your dad, a famous neurosurgeon at the Leahy Clinic, Dr. Fager, and in his obituary, there were some really amazing things said and written, and one was by a Dr. Friedberg, who succeeded your dad as the chairman of neurosurgery at Leahy Clinic, and he said about your dad and his instincts, he said he had very few complications, you know, in terms of the procedures on the patient because he was technically so good and had such good judgment. He knew when to go on. He knew when to stop. He knew when not to operate. He had fantastically good instincts about what was good for this patient. And Scott Pelley says about you, Jeff's special gift is understanding storytelling, making stories more compelling than they were and are. Part of it is learned and part of it is genetic. It's really uncanny. And this interesting parallel with you and your dad, and I'm wondering, is this thing of instinct, is this something that's genetic for you? You think it's something that's learned through training?
I don't know. I think that the storytelling is genetic. You either have it or you don't. You know, I do have it. I'm fortunate that way. We have better storytellers here than me. I think I'm a good editor. My dad is my role model. Unbelievable character. My mentor was Don Hewitt, I think, who was the best editor I ever worked with.
What is the learning curve for you on the editing? Because that's hard. You know, that's the
right.
And I see it on the other side. You know, I mean, you're in an edit bay, and you know, John Stewart comes in, and it's like, you're like, oh, that's my baby. Don't cut that. And
yeah.
You're sort of like what?
So that's what I do, and that's such an important part of what I do, and I do think that's part of why we look consistent. It looks like it belongs on 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
You know, every story. Because we
I mean, that's you. That's your gut. That's Don Hewitt. That's what you do.
However, there are a lot of things that you have to accomplish in the process of telling a story for 60 Minutes that are important, that go beyond gut. A lot of it is gut.
What are some of those things?
The way we tell a story, the words we use, the language we use. You see there's a board over there. It's called Forbidden Words. That's newspeak. We don't do it. You know, you'll never hear the kinds of words that you hear on regular newscasts on 60 Minutes. The word clear is one of them. It makes me crazy. Nothing's clear, and it's the most overused word in news. Nothing's clear. Everything's fuzzy. So we try to tell stories in the spoken word the way you would tell a story, but beautifully written at the same time.
Yeah.
That's just one way that we're very different from the rest of news. Rest of broadcast journalism, because so much of it, reporters try to, they want to sound like other reporters. So they use the same language. And before,
at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, and when you use those words in there, most of them are up there on that board.
Yeah. These days.
These days, officials say, experts say.
Right.
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 In fact, to some, to others, you know, I mean, it's like, there's so many things like that that set us apart. Which stories are we going to do and not do?
But how did you know that you needed to have that board with those words on it? I mean, you know, you're making TV. It's not like it's a live performance where you're getting direct feedback that says, hey, don't use those words. Like, how did you know?
You know, here's what's interesting about our history at CBS, and this is the only place I think that can say this. Our founding fathers, really, were Ed Murrow and Fred Friendly. They worked together here at CBS for, you know, 20 years, starting in radio. And they were amazing. They were the gentleman correspondents and producer Friendly. He's the patriarch of our whole company. They set some values and standards in place. Don Hewitt, the punk TV guy, came in and joined them.
What do you mean by the punk?
He was a young, kind of brash, feisty showman. Not really.
He came in through news.
Yeah, he started when television started. So he learned a ton from them, but he always had a showman quality. He was always, and that to the journalists of those days, TV was like the low form. That was the lowest form.
Really?
It's a gadget. It's new. We're the radio guys. They made CBS News, put it on the map with Ed Murrow because of the radio coverage from London. What makes it interesting is that.
So those guys, they looked down their nose at
they
like,
did then.
Like local TV?
There really wasn't much local TV at the time. So you're talking about the 50s. Don rose through the ranks, learned from all of them everything he could, and then became the first executive producer of the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. When Friendly became president 2 years later of CBS News, he fired Don and told him, good luck, you know, hope you can find something else to do. He came up with 60 Minutes.
Why did he fire Don?
Too much of a showman. But Don spent the rest of his career proving to those guys he understood what they meant.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Michael Jordan, you know, he doesn't start, you know,
it's best incentive ever.
Chip on your shoulder.
Yeah, and you know what? So he taught us all those things. So, you know, look, there are a lot of values and standards that we stick to that come directly from them through him.
Yeah.
You know, we don't hype, we understate. We never like to overstate. We always try to understate. We avoid the sensational. Almost always, we don't do stories to pander to a particular audience, which is the biggest flaw in news. They're trying to get young people, so they think they're going to get them by doing this kind of story. We don't do audience research to find out what people want us to cover.
You don't?
Never.
Really? Well, for people listening, that is so rare. They focus group everything. It's, you know.
Yeah, it's ridiculous because.
Hundreds of people all with their fingerprints on it, you know, trying to put on the creative, you know.
And we believe that it's our responsibility to decide what to cover, what's important, what's interesting, And the onus becomes on us to make it so damn compelling that you have to watch it.
Yeah.
So the compliment that I like the most is when someone says, boy, I watched last night. I didn't think I was going to be interested in that story, but boy, did you suck me in.
Yeah. It happens all the time. I mean, I'm flipping around and then, I'm a Patriots fan. If I happen to lucky enough Patriots game on, I'm going to watch that. Then I'm flipping around. I land on the middle of one of your stories and I'm sucked in and I end up recording the Patriots game.
Love hearing that.
And there's been a lot of copycats in your business.
But they don't copy that. They don't copy
They attempt to copycat. You know, these news magazines, it looks, it smells, it feels like it, but
yeah.
But it ain't the same thing.
It ain't. But that's one of the reasons is that as soon as they run into some kind of adversity, maybe the numbers are off a little, then they give in. They start sampling the audience. They start trying to find out, what do you want us to cover? And that's not pure journalism. So people know that.
This gets me to another thing that I want to talk about, which is the idea of hard news versus soft news. And this is a big issue with you. And in fact, in the New Canaan Darien magazine in 2015, you said, quote, with a few exceptions, our competitors are now tripping over each other to see who can be softer and sillier. And this seems to be a real issue with you about, you know, a focus and a dedication on hard news, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I could never understand it. We, as a news organization, kept reinventing the morning program in a cheaper and cheaper way.
Yep.
Now, here we are. This is the best brand, and CBS News is the best news brand in television journalism. Why would you try to copy the Today Show, which is what CBS did here for 25? So when I became chairman, it was an amazing opportunity. We're in third place. Les Moonves was ready to just hand over everything, you know, in terms of trying something different, and he wants to be proud of it. So he gave us the complete ability to reinvent the morning. And when I told everybody we're bringing Charlie Rose in, it was laughable.
I was surprised.
So I remember we were on a conference call with a group of television station managers, and I announced it. Charlie Rose is going to be the anchor of the new morning program called CBS This Morning.
Mm-hmm.
And there was total silence.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. And I remember finally the one guy spoke up who was the chairman of the board or whatever it was of the affiliates. And he said, Jeff, could you share with us the research that led you to this decision? I said, there is no research. And that is where gut comes in.
You know? And that's where gut comes in.
It does. And Charlie to us symbolized, you know, what we are about, you know, we being this strong identity of journalism that is relatively pure, you know, that really concentrates on covering what's important and making it interesting and also having fun. You know, at 60 Minutes, we take people on adventures. We do stories about celebrities. We just do fewer celebrities now because it's become such a crazy big part of our culture.
See, what's amazing is I do stand up. I tour around the country and go into these local markets and do press, radio, TV in the morning, and do these stations and TV shows called Soccer Mom Shows, which is, you know, PG mm-hmm. material. It's stay-at-home moms, stay-at-home dads, and you know, they want it kind of light, some light, easy fare to have on in the background. And so what's amazing to me is, were you not concerned that you weren't going to connect with these soccer moms, if you will, who kind of want it, you know, light? You know, you're giving them sort of hard news with a little light stuff sprinkled in. And
I think that, and I say it all the time, I think this program, 60 Minutes, proves that there's a huge appetite for that. And we are able, some of the programs that we have that get the biggest rating are the least you would expect. We did a program, a 60 Minutes on credit default swaps, gave it two parts. Credit default swaps, and it got 20 million viewers.
20 million?
Yeah. I mean, you know,
it seems just, wonky to say the least.
I know, but we tried to make it interesting, and it was the reason for the collapse, the crash of 2008. So, you know, it's amazing to me that more people don't go this way, but I think we are better qualified to. And it is part of our identity, it's part of our history, it's part of what our viewers expect.
You know, I mean, it's interesting, you know, to say, I do this podcast because I like to talk to people about process. You know, I didn't want to do just another podcast with a couple of other comedians. It's going to feel like a radio show. And I love talk shows. And, you know, growing up, my mom had bad hearing. She always had these radio shows on late at night. So I'd lie in bed and hear Larry King on the radio and watch David Susskind and, you know, who interviewed a hitman for the mob. It was fascinating. And it just, I'm interested in process. I'm interested in knowing about things that I don't know anything about. And so it does make sense to me that credit default swaps could actually be something that people would want to sort of delve into. I mean, it's not something you're going to order up on your dial, but I do think there's something to kind of, you know, sort of bringing things to people that they don't know anything about and sort of enlightening.
Yeah, and learn something, get something out of it. And I so believe much more valuable than giving them something you think they want is to give them something in an hour that they give us that they take away and say, I got something out of that. I got something out of that. They'll tell a friend, they'll come back for more. And so in rebuilding the morning, to me, that's the proof.
So how does Gail King come into that mix?
We really wanted a mix. That was Chris Licks' idea, Gail. And so we really studied her and thought hard about, you know, we want to be able to cover everything. We want the diversity, first of all, which you need because it's such a diverse everything.
The world is diverse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she, to me, was one of the better interviewers. She had a radio program.
And I think what she's great at is she kind of loosens Charlie up a little bit.
She does. And the mix of people is so interesting. What we couldn't predict and were pleasantly surprised, and probably the most memorable thing about this morning program is that they get along so well. They're real pals. I mean, they show it on the air, and they I think that they work off each other.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like one morning I'm watching, and, you know, she says something a little, you know, salty, and he, you know, kind of blushed a little bit. But then a couple minutes later, then he said something too, and it was a nice sort of bringing that out of each other.
Yeah, they do. But I think what they have in common is they're smart, and they don't have any instructions to do something cheap and pandering. We got rid of the kitchen. We don't do cooking. We got rid of the weather because local weather's local. We don't underestimate it, and we'll cover it as a story. But, you know, it became something else. It became entertainment. So to us, there was a big gaping hole on the landscape of morning television.
Right.
Probably the most important area for a news organization because there's more money in it. And we weren't making any. And nobody was watching. And it's like, if you're going
to
fail.
What do we have to lose?
Yeah, what do we have to lose? If you're going to be in third place, why not be proud?
Yeah, exactly.
And so the amazing thing 6 years later is that it's 5 years, I guess, almost six. I've lost track. It's an incredible success story.
Yeah, for you and for Ryan and Chris. I mean, Chris works on The Late Show. They're a really bright guy.
Very bright. Working with him on that was, and that staff that he built with Ryan and everybody, was one of the, I think, most fulfilling experiences I've ever had in 35 years.
Yeah, you know, Chris, like, you know, he has these, like, weekly staff meetings for the entire show.
Yeah, it's important.
Which is great. You know, a lot of times senior managers don't communicate well to the crew in a company, and he's great. You know, he took a lot off of Stephen's plate, you know, because, you know, working on The Daily Show, and I think this is something that, you know, you take with you forever, is like, Jon Stewart used to have a saying, you got to keep your foot on the throat of the show, which means you got to pay attention to every detail. Well, you know, with The Late Show, Colbert Report went from 83 hours of programming a year, 4 days a week, half hour a day, to, you know, 202 hours a year and a staff of over 200. So it was great to kind of free Stephen up. You know, it was really important.
No, I noticed it. And
he's such
a
terrific producer, Chris. And
yeah, he is.
A really nice guy.
And I had suggested Chris for that job.
Is that right?
And I think that I thought with so many, what made him remarkable on the morning program is that there are so many moving parts. And to be you have to be a multitasker, you know, the best kind. You got to be able to decide so many things at once. And I did that job, and I had that ability. Not as good as Chris. I never had to do the morning. I did the evening. And Chris, I noticed, was so good at it that it seemed to me he'd be perfect for Colbert. And I've noticed a difference in the program. I mean, I just think there's a sharpness to it that, and I think it's more current.
Yeah, you know.
I think that the use of tape within the monologue is amazing.
Coming on, creating a new show, like the Late Show with Colbert, you know, I think Stephen's like figuring out, you know, what is the show? How political is it going to be? And it's become pretty political, and that's a really cool thing. And it's really amazing that, you know, CBS is letting a show do that. You know, that's a real credit to CBS.
Well, what I think makes us different is that we're run by a creative guy. He's creative, and he's a businessman and a really good one, but he's a content guy. So I've always found that great. You know, I never get a call from Les saying, why the hell did you do that story? Ever.
Well, he's a good manager, and he hires good people and lets them do what they do.
Well, I think he respects the wall between, you know, the business and the news, and more than anybody that I've ever heard of.
You're able to do that here? Is a big franchise, but let them do that?
We do, and we like people to cover stories that they want to cover. You know, that I think is the most important part, because you're going to live with it for a long time. With Les, what makes it, I think, unusual is that he's a creative content guy who understands that he likes what we're doing. If he didn't, he'd change it out.
There's no concern like, you know, well, if we slam Trump a lot, we're going to lose a whole bunch of viewers.
No.
And, you know, it's about getting, numbers into
there's
the
none of that.
Tent, you know?
He's very involved in talent selection at CBS News and always has been. So that's something that we talk about, you know, who's going to be the correspondents, who's the future. No, in terms of the content of the news organization, he respects that line.
Well, one of the things that, you know, I want people to understand is when they're watching, you know, a show like 60 Minutes or these shows, the people that go, that are behind putting this information out there that inform the viewer and what's involved and, you know, the thought process and, you know, talking about the tenure of Dan Rather, you were overseeing the evening news and Dan Rather came on board, and this was a time when you felt like you had to get back to more hard news, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's something that I've done almost every place I've gone, is to just to make it more current.
And not be covering sort of the lighter, fluffier stuff.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what actually, when I took over 60 Minutes, and 60 Minutes goes through cycles, you know, where it's newsier and not as newsy over all our years, and it evolves. But I felt there were too many stories getting done before we even had our season premiere, which means they're evergreens. They can go on any time during the year. And they had as many as 40 done. Now, that means you're finishing a story in September that could run in March or April.
So you're not current.
And I can't stand that. I want it to be current. I want every story to feel like it's part of today's world. As in today, this month, this week, this year. You know,
it's not just a job for you. It's a calling.
Yeah, it is. And it's an opportunity. Everything is. And I think even for the... And we're not going to do a profile of somebody who isn't relevant in some way. We did
because they might have a big name and draw eyeballs.
Correct. We did Denzel Washington this week, and I love that story because it's about the playwright August Wilson, basically. And
so the story had a reason for being.
Yeah, that Fences, this movie, is about really this great work by August Wilson, and it's a play brought to the screen. And that's really what the story became about.
And the fact that Denzel was at the center of it is a gravy, so to speak. It's not the tail wagging the dog.
No, it's not.
It's like, we got to get Denzel in there, so you sort of jam a reason to do the story.
Correct.
When you don't want to...
It's the other way around.
So, you know, it's interesting. You were asked like about stories that reflect your own sensibilities, and you actually picked two that were done by Bob Simon. One on the U.S. pilot shot down over Iraq, and another was... on the Lost Boys of the Sudan, both foreign reports that, you know, that kind of runs counter to news magazines' trends toward domestic crime stories and celebrity interviews. So what is it about those stories that really resonate with you?
First of all, our international footprint is pretty large.
Yeah.
And I think people expect it, and thank God, because we do a lot of it, and we should. We help people better understand the big stories in the world.
Right.
We just did an Aleppo story that I thought was one of the most powerful stories we've done. Or has been done, the war in Syria. Those stories, it's interesting, that must have come from a while ago, and I still think of those stories as two of my favorites, the Lost Boys in particular. I kept telling Bob and Dragon, the producer, go back and do another. I think we did four versions of it.
Is that right?
Yeah, because we kept following these Lost Boys. For me, it was such a compelling human story. It doesn't matter where the hell it is. A compelling human story told well is going to resonate.
Yeah, you know, it's like the person out there, like in Chappaquiddick or Stonington, Connecticut or wherever, is not going to know unless you're bringing it to them.
And they're going to, that's right. And you know, those stories are harder to do. They're more expensive. That we have huge budget to do our stories. That's another part of it. The story about the pilot that was shot down, that took a couple of years. I mean, we were reporting it for a long time. He disappeared in Iraq. And that's the kind of story it takes a long time to bring to the screen.
Is there a point in the story where you go, you know what, guys, we just don't...
let's give up.
Yes. And that's a gut thing. You, right?
Yeah, that's when we know. Well, we never really give up on a story unless it's, you know, lost. There's no chance we're going to be able to fix it or get it on the air. A couple times a year. It's not very much. You know, but some of them take a lot of reporting, and that really is where you spend money.
So I just wanted to read something that you said, Jeff. As you said, working for months on a percolating story isn't as common as it once was, but that doesn't mean the reporting in it is any less compelling. Why isn't it as common as it once was? What did you mean by that?
Look, sometimes it takes a couple of years. Sometimes it takes a couple of weeks. Sometimes it takes a weekend. You know, and our job is to make sure it looks like it's a real 60-minute story. You know, you've gotten the kind of substance.
Right.
You've taken away a lot of information, whether we call it crashed it on the air or whether we worked on it for 2 years.
Do you find that the process is very different for a foreign story versus a domestic story?
It's harder. It's always harder.
Because of the sheer logistics?
Sometimes. Logistics have gotten easier now because the gear is better.
Yeah.
It's easier to feed a piece. It's easier to bring material in. But when we work in the United States at 60 Minutes, we pretty much can open doors.
Yeah.
Anywhere we want.
Yeah, that's true.
In the world, we can too. It's tougher.
And it's about access.
Not always about access. But, you know, it's also about reporting. People are more willing to tell us things who have more experience with us, you know.
You spent some time in London, you were based in London from 85 to 88, and you said something really interesting, quote, it got a little strange. You know, you were covering all sorts of international stories, and you say, it got a little strange, racing to cover the bombing of Libya or the Palestinian-Israeli conflicts. You get to like it too much. It gets the blood going. It's addictive. So you pull the plug, in your words, and return to the U.S. I'm fascinated by that. What was that all about?
I think it's adrenaline. By the way, I think people don't realize that it's part of PTSD, that the level of excitement involving when you're in a conflict zone of some kind is scary, fascinating.
You mean as a viewer of it? For
no, I think as a to actually be in those situations where
you mean as the reporter, the producer, yeah, on the ground.
Yeah, because, and I say PTSD loosely when it comes to reporters, they suffer it though, and I think a lot of them suffer it because they've seen trauma, but a lot of them suffer it because they don't have that level of excitement. So I think I know a lot of people who end up in conflict zone coverage and don't give it up for the rest of their life
because the juice of it.
Yeah, and by the way, it becomes addictive. And I think that's an adrenaline thing as well. You can't imagine what it's like to be in a aerial bombing situation. I mean, it's frightening. But there's something...
I was thinking, like, yeah, that's the last place I'd want to be.
I know, but it gets in your blood. And there are reporters who struggle with that and end up doing too much of it and put themselves in harm's way.
Yeah, you know, you're away from your... You're separated from the family.
Well,
and
you live away from your family a lot, and I had young sons when we lived in London, and my wife was amazing. I mean, she never put pressure on me because the job made it difficult to have family life. But I put pressure on myself. The first offer I got to come back to New York after 3.5 years, I said yes to, because I felt it. I felt that I was...
If you stayed, do you think that would have made you like you would have split from your family?
No. I mean, those road jobs are really good for people in their late 20s and early 30s. You know, I mean, it's amazing how stressful it can be and strenuous when you're out there covering stories for a month at a time.
In terms of your craft, what did that do for you?
Everything.
You know, being out there.
Everything.
It made you better at...
Well, I just think that in terms of professionally, it was the best experience I ever had, ever, ever, ever. And I tell young people this all the time, that you need to be in daily journalism for a period of your career, because managing deadline, especially if it's a daily deadline, is the most healthy thing to do. You learn to be more efficient with shooting tape, for example. You learn how to tell your story while you're reporting it.
Yeah.
You write notes about how you're going to tell it. Sometimes it has to happen right away. And you are a much more efficient producer or reporter. You know what it takes to put a story together in no time at all. Comes in so handy. I think over time, the best producers at 60 Minutes have been people who came from hard news.
You know, yeah, it's like anything, you know, you gotta learn your craft from the ground up, and no matter what organization you're in, you know, like at the Daily Show, you know, you don't realize it at the time. You know, it's like practicing law, you know what you're doing in law school,
right,
as a law student, but it's different than once you get out in the real world and
right,
learn how to be a lawyer. Same thing at the Daily Show, you know, you're working on these stories and these jokes, and you don't realize the kind of training you're getting at the bare bones level, and then the skill sets that you're developing that you'll use for the rest of your life later in life.
And I remember I got offers to be, you know, senior producer, which I think people do way too early in life. And I just said, I'm not ready. I can't be a senior producer helping people with their story without more of this experience.
Well, what is the added responsibility of a senior producer?
Well, you're an editor. You become an editor. So in other words, you're going to help someone make their story better. Rewrite, change this, change that. What I do, basically. So I didn't say yes to that till I was 39 years old.
Yeah.
And to me, that was the most valuable, smartest thing I did. Even, you know, I knew that I didn't think I was ready.
Wow, that's so unique. I mean, yeah. Most people are like, yeah, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Promotion, senior producer, bigger title, more money, sexier job.
I know, but I was a producer at 60 Minutes. I remember my brother-in-law, who is a lawyer, once said, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. I love what I'm doing. Well, you know, I don't know what I want to do. I never had a plan for like the next thing because I was enjoying it too much. But I did know that I wasn't ready to come in the building and start editing other people's copy. I needed more time. And in that process, I experienced every kind of story you could ever imagine reporting.
Is there a time when you're like, ooh, this, you're in over your head and, you know, there's too many tentacles here. There's too many storylines.
Yeah.
I don't know where the spine should be. And how do you get yourself
sure
out of that?
Yeah, usually, I mean, this is such a collaborative business. And we're always better when we're good collaborators. We have a real tradition of that between producer and correspondent, which really goes back to Friendly and Murrow.
Right.
And as equals, not as one person working for another, but working together to make the story better. So there's always someone here is going to help you out of a jam. And we all run into them.
Yeah.
You know, and what I love about a collaborative, creative enterprise is that we all have real strengths and we all have real weaknesses.
Right.
And our teams are best when they're compatible that way.
Yeah.
Like his strength makes up for my weakness.
Right.
And that's when I think we're at our best as well.
Like you got some days where somebody's on, somebody's off. So it's a numbers game. You know, statistically, somebody's going to be on, somebody's going to be off. So you have 12 people and you cover yourself. And like I did, I've created some of my own shows, like a sports comedy show, had an approach of, you know, I want a variety of people. Like the network's like, why are you hiring these people? It's like, well, because I don't want everybody approaching this from the same point of view, right? Like I don't want all sports writers.
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, so we just had an opening for we have one senior producer on our sports program, 60 Minutes Sports.
Right.
Which we love. We work hard on it. And we hired Tanya Simon, who happens to be Bob Simon's daughter, but an amazing talent producer on her own. And she didn't know anything about sports. And she's the senior producer. And the great thing is that she brings such a fresh perspective. And it's, you know, it makes a difference. And
yeah, you know, they'll ask a question that you as a sports fan wouldn't think of, and you go, oh yeah, that's a really, really good question.
Yeah, it's true. It is what makes us better, which is that we, you know, we all come to it with a different, you know, collection of talents and strengths and weaknesses. And so it's, you know, and as long as we're aware of that,
yeah,
that's what I think. That's when we're firing on all pistons.
It's hard making a show. You know, you're making a show, and it's like I always say, you're making the donuts and you're making the machine that makes the donuts at the same time. Like, and 2.5 million people are watching. And so there's always, you know, people with opinions, yeah, and critics.
That's right.
And I love the interview Leslie Stahl did with Trump, you know, after with his family. And then she reads the letters after the following week, and they're like, completely opposites. Like
we get that a lot. That's when you know you're doing your job. You can read that one. You got to look at that. That's one of the great letters that ever came in. I'm not sure how, like, censored is this program.
No, you can say whatever.
Well,
you agenda-driven, cocksucking motherfucker. Report the whole story and not the parts that just support your fucking opinion. It's no wonder you have zero credibility. When we finish with Saddam, we need to take a look at you jagoffs. That is the best.
So you know where that letter comes from. This is an interesting story. That letter came after we interviewed Saddam Hussein on 60 Minutes, too, right before the whole thing came down.
Yep.
And he said, I don't have weapons of mass destruction. And everybody accused us of going too soft on him. Of course he has them. And Dan Rather did the interview. He pressed him.
Right.
We're reporting. We're asking him. And Dan pressed him. But you can't press him hard enough if he's going to say, I don't have them. Because everybody believes he has them.
Right.
And he didn't.
Right.
So it's a crazy, crazy
right.
irony
yeah.
about all of that. And we get this, well, I love this letter. It's one of the great letters. There's usually one or two in each week's mail that's memorable. But we get this letter calling us a bunch of jackoffs for, you know, sharing our, not being tough enough on Saddam. You know, we went too easy. We got criticized pretty heavily.
You did.
Yeah, I remember.
So when you get those letters and you're sitting around the office with the powers that be, which you are, do you start to think, well, maybe, you know, we missed something? Or
yeah, yeah.
How can the rest of the world yeah. be wrong
yeah,
and we're right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you make mistakes, and we do, it's tough because, I mean, you look, you know, we are held to a very high standard. Now, that was not an example where we made a mistake.
Yeah, no, you had your Blair Logan thing with Benghazi,
yeah.
and I really admired how you handled it. You fessed up to it, and you're like, okay, I'm at the helm, I'm running this thing, I'm responsible, and you took it right in the gut, and, you know.
Yeah, it was not good, and that's what you have to do. You know, Don Hewitt was very good at this. He taught us all, don't ever hide from something. Come out and look into it and admit it if it's true. So he was really good at apologizing. God knows he had to do it. And so did we. And in that case, look, it was bad. The guy lied to
yeah,
us.
Yeah, it's the cover-up that gets you, you know, like Nixon.
Yeah.
So then, you know, you did something really amazing. In 98, you launched 60 Minutes 2. And, you know, that was really an undertaking because you've got the show, 60 Minutes. It's like, and there's clones of 60 Minutes. It's like, do you need another show? And it was really, I mean, unbelievable. And then, you know, his quote here, it says, he pulled off the impossible, turning the newcomer into an award-winning program that didn't embarrass his tradition, but nonetheless carved out its own identity and journalistic voice.
Really good run.
How did you do that? I mean, that was really pretty amazing.
Well, first of all, I had huge help from everybody up here, including Don Hewitt, who was totally against this.
He thought it was going to water down,
and,
you know, the main
yeah,
franchise.
Yeah, totally against it. And when he was presented with it, the only compromise they made was they'd accept it if I ran it. Because I was running the evening news, they were proud of it, I came from here. That was a compromise that they all agreed on, and they were still, you know, skeptical. But the job was to make it, I told the staff over and over again, I want them to wish they had the story we have, you know, on Sunday.
So then how are you getting, like, the good shows and the good stories? Because it seems like, you know, they're going to get a main dibs on the good juicy stuff.
Well, so we based it on a lot more reporting and current news reporting, which we did a lot more of.
So 60 Minutes was more sort of like a 30,000 foot view of stories.
A little bit more, yeah. And so, but you see, that's a really good picture up there, all the way up. It's morally safer with my head on a platter.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny. And he brought that to me. I was quoted in the paper when they were asking me about 60 Minutes 2. Am I going to try to beat 60 Minutes? I quoted my minister saying, John the Baptist always said it's okay to be number two because we know who number one is.
Ah, nice.
So that's what he did. He had my head cut off on that platter, and it says, the punishment of St. Jeff the Baptist.
Morley Safer just seemed like he was just a really great guy, cultured, really cool. And I'm just looking around the office. You've got just amazing things here, pictures of Mike Wallace and all the great, great correspondents. But Morley Safer seems like an amazing guy.
So that little statue over there, Morley made that. Those are two guys wrestling. And it's and
one guy's got his hand on the other guy's
yeah pulling it, and it says the tranquil transition Hewitt to Fager. That's what he wrote underneath it.
People don't know, like, journalists are gonna get real bawdy, you know.
Yeah, That's Morley's. It's a piece of art, I guess. It's called We Coffee on Cheap Curtain. He threw coffee at me once because we got in a fight, and he missed. I ducked, and it went all over his curtain.
What were you fighting, or what was the?
I pulled a practical joke on him, and it got him, and he threw coffee. And so then, so he cut out when they changed the curtains 10 years later. He cut out the part with the stain. It's now kind of washed out.
So but, yeah, this is amazing.
Oh, and there's a sod with Charlie Rose. You see that one?
And who's that giving the finger?
Oh, that's Eminem. That was one of our producers, Tanya Simon, again, who went out and interviewed him and said, send a message to my boss.
Yeah, this is a picture of Eminem sitting in a car with his hat pulled down, giving the finger to the camera. Andy Rooney, oh, man. Oh,
I actually remember that's at a Super Bowl party. And probably either that or the year before, he was always at a party. He always had his Maker's Mark on the rocks. And if they didn't have Maker's Mark, he'd say, they never have the bourbon you want. Bruce Taub, who's the CFO of the CBS television network. I said, Andy, you got to meet, Bruce was right there. I said, you got to meet Bruce Taub. He's the CFO of the CBS television network. He's the guy who signs your check every single week. He's responsible for all that money at CBS. And Andy looks at him, he says, well, nobody's perfect. He loved being Andy Rooney, you know, on and off the air.
So how do you tap into the different strengths, you know, of these different, you know, reporters? They're all amazing, and talk about what strengths they each possess.
So Morley was the consummate sort of writer, storyteller. He could take an adventure and make it into a magical journey, you know, with a turn of phrase. Mike and Ed were more similar in that they brought great interview skills and listening and spontaneous ability. And that, surprisingly, is the hardest thing to come by, that someone can put their notes aside and have this conversation. Now, the difference with them is that it almost didn't matter who Mike was interviewing, whether it was Johnny Carson or President Reagan, it was just as tough. And Ed was a much more gentle, had a much more gentle approach, and usually got the goods.
Are there times when, you know, they're sitting in the edit bay after the fact and going, maybe, you know, pushed a little too hard there?
Yeah, I mean, Mike crossed the line. Mike loved to argue, and he'd push back, and he'd fight, and he was such a delightful guy. I miss him. I miss them all so much. They really were unique characters, and fun. You know, this place has always been fun. And I think that surprises people to know how much fun we have. Mike was a big heart, very fun guy with a really serious depression problem, clinical depression. And he became the poster boy for it. And, you know, was, I think, incredibly courageous for going out.
Was the depression tied to, you know, him, Mike, feeling like, oh, you know, tied to work, you know, like my work isn't good enough?
Well, there was a particular story that was a trigger. It was the Westmoreland case and a big trial of, you know, defamation case, and which we ended up not losing. It wasn't 60 Minutes. It was CBS Reports. But that set him off. And so he was one of the first, you know, big public figures to really come out and talk about it. And he was courageous, and he was tough, and he was fun, and he was funny. And if you got him at the wrong time of day when he was depressed, he could be a complete prick.
So where do you get the balls, you know, to sort of tell these guys who are, you know, veteran journalists and brilliant at what they do, like, no, you're wrong on that. We should do it this way. You know, sort of like telling Tom Brady, no, throw the football that way. How does that work with these guys?
I think, you know, truthfully, you learn as you get older that you should back off often, you know, that you're never always right. But I did, you have to, in these positions, earn the respect. And I think that, you know, at first there was real concern. Don's been here for 35 years. Here's a new guy coming in. We know him. He's one of us. But this is a big change. And, you know, we're all very comfortable and feeling good. Well, if you, the first piece you fix or make a change that helps make the piece better, it's not, you know, you see it. You know it. It's your story. You've been working hard on it. That made a difference.
Then you build human capital with these guys.
You earn it, build it, and it builds quickly. And it's interesting because Mike Wallace and I were probably the closest, and Morley and I, of all of the correspondents. And I expected, though, that because they were the senior guys, they would object. They would be the hardest. At first, Ed Bradley and Leslie Stahl were the hardest. Now, once we did enough together and I won them over, I'd known them well.
Is it because Ed and Leslie were maybe a little less established and maybe a little less secure about,
I don't know,
you know, their own position?
It was harder to win them over. Once I did, you know, it was great, and it took about a year. But, you know, I understood that. I understood that. I mean, if you, you know, look, I worked with Don, too. I was just awed by him, and the idea that he was leaving made us all anxious. I was confident because I've been doing it long enough. You know, at that point, I was, you know, 8 years as an executive producer in Hard News and at 62, and proud of what we'd accomplished. So I came in pretty confident.
You know, the thing that jumps out, too, is, you know, Morley Safer pointed out about you, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, that you bring a well-rounded aspect to your work. You're a family guy. You're committed to what you do, but you're a nice guy. You have a good demeanor about you, and I think that really makes for a good workplace. And no matter how big you've gotten, that does not seem to have gotten to your head. So, you know, you had said that an important trait for a reporter to have is humility. You spoke at a journalism conference, and also you told interns this as well. What did you mean by that?
My point is that we're just reporters. You know, I mean, that's what you asked me. How do I deal with these tough people who have been doing this for so long? I think part of that is my dad. You know, I grew up in a house where my dad was dealing with life and death every day, and so I have such a respect for that. And look, we are just reporters. We're not important in the sense that we're self-important. And self-importance really bothers me. And that level of humility, especially in an area where reporters became celebrities on television, that's not good.
Yeah, they became the story.
That's not healthy. And, you know, in some ways it's funny because I remember people would say, don't put Dan Rather on hold. He'll get mad. And one of the rules up here at 60 Minutes, too, when we first started, and Dan, I was very close with, put him on hold like everybody else. This is not about, you know, stars. And Don Hewitt, it's part of his genius. He built this place as an ensemble. And, you know, the truth is, if you can't take that, if you need to be the star, you shouldn't be here. And just like The Daily Show, you know, you have to be able to, you know, and you had a king among equals. I mean, and Mike Wallace was that to a degree. And so was Don Hewitt. So you don't, but it really is an ensemble. And I think that I never had a problem telling them that's not appropriate or that doesn't work in this story because they're just reporters. And you know, that's the thing about Mike Wallace, the movie that was made, The Insider, didn't do him any favors. He was not a pompous ass. He was a regular guy. The truth is there wasn't a single shred of bullshit in the guy. And that's what made him so appealing on the air. Almost didn't care who he was interviewing. It was just like, I'm going to watch because I can't wait to hear what the hell he's going to ask next.
You talk about your dad, and he was quite an accomplished guy.
By the way, I'm not as humble as my dad. He had a humility that was...
He was the head of neurosurgery at the Lahey Clinic,
right.
And always made sure that he was home at like 5:30.
6:30, because he operated at 6:30 in the morning.
And, you know, my father-in-law... very good at OBGYN, and he was a very nice guy, but a lot of these surgeons can have like a god complex, and your dad, from what I sense, did not. Like, what is that, where you get your sound of grounded nature from?
Yeah, huge. I'm telling you, I in my eulogy to all his grandchildren, I said, you know, it's going to be impossible to live up to this guy. I couldn't. And you know, but we can do our best on a number of fronts. A level of humility that is uncommon. And I still think about him. He died 2 years ago. I think about him so much, and I think about just a happy guy who was very good at what he did.
Did he talk to you about your work?
He called every Sunday night. Mostly he was a viewer who just loved 60 Minutes, you know what I mean? And he was proud that his son was producing it. You know?
He did this really cool thing. At 15, he had you go down to Florida.
Oh, he didn't. I did that on my own. In other words, it was a patient of his. God, you're good. Oh, my God.
His trainer, Mr. Nehrud, had a bad accident. Your father saved his life. And a horse was named after your father, Dr. Fager.
Yeah.
Very, very famous thoroughbred horse. Very fast.
One of the great horses of all time. He still holds a world record for the mile 40 years later.
So how did you come to end up working on Mr. Nehrud's farm?
So I was probably, 13 when I first met him. And I remember around that time, I said, I want to come work on your farm, on the horse farm in Florida. And I obviously was too young at that point. But the next time he came to visit, I said, I really want to come work at Tartan Farms. It was owned by 3M. It was a huge farm, but as a farm hand, and they had 1,000 head of thoroughbred horses. So he said, yes. My mother said, God, are you sure? And he said, it ain't going to hurt him none. But it was pretty wild. I was 15 on my own, basically.
So what was it about that you thought, I want to do that?
Adventure. I wanted to get out. I wanted adventure. I had that in me. I don't think anybody would let their 15-year-old kid do what they let me do. And I did it as a 15, 16-year-old. And at 17, I went to the racetrack in New York City and lived in the quarters. And there, you're surrounded in that scenario by addicts and all kinds of people that I love.
What way did that whole experience going down to Florida like that at that age inform you as an adult? You've said it had a big impact on you for your whole life.
I don't know. I think we pamper our kids a little too much. And I think that being out in the world and having to do things on your own, interact with people from all walks of life, is a really healthy thing. It just, I don't know, I grew up. So I was going to say that my dad, one of the happiest moments in my life was when I took Don's job, and the Boston Globe did a big story about it. And they said, is he your role model, Don Hewitt? And I said, no, my dad's my role model. And they put that on the front page.
Oh, wow.
And everybody at the Leahy Clinic saw it.
The obituary on your father is the Boston Globe. People should Google it. It's just an amazing write-up. And a lot of egos in medicine, and you've got a lot of famous, brilliant doctors singing his praises. As I mentioned, Dr. Friedberg, but others, saying that, he was a king among kings, but treated everybody equally and with respect. And it's just really a really impressive guy.
Yeah, he was a wonderful guy. He was a wonderful guy. So, how blessed to grow up in a house with a dad like that who was an amazing, he didn't have to spend a lot of time telling us stuff, although he didn't allow television in the house.
That's so funny because you work in TV.
I know. And it's funny because we could watch, Friday night was like a treat night, and we could watch on Sunday night, but no other television. He called it brain rot. And so I'm a little guy thinking, oh my God, he knows a lot about the brain. Wow, brain rot? That can happen? He knows what he's talking about.
Did you think medicine was the thing you wanted to do? Surgery,
I was not into sciences. I just wasn't. And he never pushed anybody. It's like, you got to do what you want to do with your life. And I think he had four kids, and they all ended up doing something a little different. And that really excited him.
I know you like to go to Saratoga. You say the food's great there.
Well, I'm into horse. I have racehorses. I'm really into that. So, and I never lost that love. And the guy, the great trainer, John Nehrud, who's, one of the patriarchs of the sport, one of the founders of the Breeders' Cup that my dad saved, he died at 102. And, he almost died at 55. And he had that operation at, which was emergency surgery on a horrible brain injury. And he helped me get into the racehorsing business.
Well, what is it about horse racing that...
It's the best distraction ever. It's like fishing to me. I love golf. And I love fishing, and I love this horse racing thing because it's like it takes you away. Yeah, this is intense. It's one of the things about this life and this job is that it doesn't end. It doesn't end because it's Saturday. The show's on Sunday. Stuff happens.
You got horses running right now?
There's a couple at Aqueduct. They live at Belmont. There's two in Florida, and there's one in Ireland.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Good reason to go to Ireland. Real quick, you guys were ahead of the curve. Donald Trump, you covered him going back initially 1985.
Yeah, we were. And I started talking to him in May about doing the president-elect interview. And nobody else was talking to him.
Did you see it coming that he would win?
No. But I wanted to make sure we were covered in case he did. So I was talking to him all summer about
it. Because you had that long history with him and all of that.
Yeah, and we had difficulty with him, too. He was mad at me, and mad as hell, and after a story we did in the year 2000. He was doing an exploratory run for president. And we showed a shot where there were a lot of empty seats, and he thought we had manufactured that. And I told him we hadn't. It was fair and it was right. And look, sorry you feel that way, but, and we made up. I'd seen him over the years. I'd see him at Yankee Stadium. And so I have what I think is a good relationship, having been in both places with him. And
he seems to have good instincts, and that really carried him through this. Did it surprise you that his instincts were that spot on?
No. He's a really, really smart guy. And he tapped into something and he started to feel it. You know, that I thought was one of the most interesting things about what he noticed. This doesn't feel like second place. Everywhere he went, thousands and thousands.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty amazing. I saw this stat, you know, in the Rust Belt states, you know, the blue wall that he broke through and all of that. He visited those states 173 times. He visited 88 times.
Yeah, imagine. Oh, I think I got to go.
Well, there you have it. And he had to go. Jeff Fager, executive producer of 60 Minutes, literally put the mic down. He dropped the mic. It was a drop the mic moment, and he walked out of the office because he had a big screening to do for an upcoming 60 Minutes piece. And then he took me into the screening room to meet the people, and there were literally 12 people screening a piece. And I have to tell you, just imagine you write an essay, and then 12 people in front of you are going to critique it. It's not, it's a little stressful, I can imagine. So, but that's what they do at 60 Minutes. Very thorough and the best at what they do. A thank you to Jeff Fager for an amazing interview. I hope you enjoyed it and hope you kind of get something out of it in terms of how somebody makes some of the best television in the history of television and has been doing it for so long. And just got a sense of the person as a man and as a boss, as a father, as a husband, as a son. Thank you for listening. And please go check out the podcast. We've got other great interviews that are out there on iTunes and Audio Boom. And go review the podcast as well on iTunes. And we will see you next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.